Welcome to the Museum of Modern Art. My name is Paola Antonelli, and I'm a curator in the Department of Architecture and Design in this museum. Welcome to Conversations with the Artist, and this is a really great program that the museum has launched many years ago, and it's supported by one of our affiliate groups, the Junior Associates. And you know, we rotate amongst the departments, and when the Department of Architecture and Design gets lucky and gets its chance, we try to invite the people that we find most interesting that are possibly near or around New York, but not necessarily, and that we think have really something special to say to the audience, which is sometimes an audience that is composed not only of designers. That's why this year, when I was asked by Laura Bayless and Pablo Helguera to pick a person, I picked my great friend and one of the best designers I know, Ron Gilat. Ron is a really, really special person, and we met about 6 years ago, and we immediately hit it off, even though he tried his best not to hit it off with me. He has this kind of dry and really grating way sometimes of introducing himself to people, while instead he is the most fabulous and sweet also. Don't tell anybody that I told you that, because he will kill me afterwards, person. But talking professionally about Ron, what struck me instantly about him, and I'm really jaded, I'm mean, you know, I go around, I see a lot of design, and I was really taken aback by his work, is that it is so incredibly subtle. You know, one of the biggest gifts that a designer and a design commentator can have is the capacity of synthesis, being able to really distill everything down to its minimum. And it's not simply minimalism, it really is something more. It's getting to the core of objects and to the core of design and being able to concentrate all of the meaning of the world in a fruit bowl that is like a boxing ring for apples, or in a lamp that sits this big on an enormous pedestal. It's this gift of being able to really displace our habits towards objects that I found so great in Ron. And then as I got to know him better, I found out many more similarities between the two of us. For instance, he also studied architecture like I did, and just like me said that, you know, thought he just didn't have time to wait to get something built in 25 or 30 years. Just this lack of patience that brings you to become obsessive and to really try to get things done as soon as you can and as best as you can. And also, he has a lot of references in his work that references or idols or heroes that are very similar to mine. I don't know how many of you here know the work of Enzo Mari, a really wonderful and totally impossible human being and wonderful designer that I exhort you all to research if you don't know him already, Mari, M-A-R-I. You'll see that there's the same kind of apparent simplicity that in reality hides so much complexity that one cannot even start to describe. You know, Ron is Israeli, of course, but who cares, and is a creature of the world, lives in New York, could live somewhere else, really could transport his work everywhere he goes because there's a communicative in his objects that goes beyond any language, any kind of translation, and any kind of interpretation. I'll stop here because he has something like 250 slides, although he promised that he will not show it them for more than 35 minutes, 149, but we're going to hold him to 35 minutes. So we're going to start with his presentation, then we're going to sit here and have a little bit of a panel and take questions also from the audience. And, you know, if I don't have any good questions, I'll ask you right away. No, I'm kidding, but I'll try to involve you as much as possible. So, Ron, please come here. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you, Paola, for inviting me here and for this very warm introduction. What you already know is that I have problems with time restraints, so please feel free to poke me whenever you want me to stop. Good evening, and thank you for coming. What Paola forgot to say is that sometimes my English is as creative as my work, so please try to bear with me. I believe the design world is mature enough in order to explore its own premises. I use objects as tools to intrigue our perception. My main work deals with the relationship between the objects and their own function. I will describe for a couple of minutes, just in general, my theories before I will start hit you up with so many slides that hopefully will not bore you too much. We are all familiar with all the everyday objects that surrounds us from birth. They are engaged in our subconscious to the extent that we are almost ignoring them in our everyday. What I'm trying to do is to renew our appreciation and refresh our perception about them. A small story which I find quite touching. My mother's rabbi once described what I do in a very interesting way. He said that in my studio I act like a little god that create creatures. But he also mentioned that these little creatures who has volume and made out of material are just bodies. And without having soul and idea, these are just dead bodies. So in my work, as much as I can, I'm trying to inject soul and content into the objects, although they're always stripped almost to their minimum. To speak metaphorically, I see myself almost as a linguist. I'm trying to create my own language through objects. I think that none of the objects are trying to make a whole story by themselves, but each object is a symbol of a specific character. I will show a body of work because what I'm showing is some kind of an offer for the users in order to create their own language or to write their own poems by using these objects. I don't create new words. I rely on what already exists. I'm trying to understand the meaning of words and their origin in order to create new synonyms. Isaac Newton once said that if I've seen further, it is because I'm standing on shoulders of giants, and I'm a big believer of it. The wheel has already been invented, and I think that lots of many other things. And what we are doing is doing connections between unseemingly related things. My objects are not innovative nor more comfortable or useful than others. On the contrary, sometimes in order to use them, one needs to suffer. I think that most of the time comfort makes us numb, and I'm trying to wake us up with these objects. I allow myself to explore as much as possible rather than just do, and in these cases I'm making a lot of mistakes. Over the time I learned how to use these mistakes in a more positive ways and have benefit of this doubt. This evening I will start with one of my biggest mistakes. The Dear Ingo Light has been designed in 2003. I designed it as a joke. It was a test for me to see if I'm able, through objects, communicate with other designer, in this case, the big master of lighting, Ingo Maurer. I didn't design it with the dedication and being as specific as I used to design my object. It was just a little statement. However, someone took it a little bit too seriously. And I'm sure that you know how it is when suddenly you hear the same joke over and over again. So for me, I cannot look at this object anymore, since I don't think that it represents the way I think about objects. I divide most of my objects into containers and surfaces. This is my very retarded way to simplify things. I will start with a series of fruit bowls, which were a specific function I chose in order to explore the meaning of what a container is. The first conclusion was that after paring down the structure of a bowl, I left with a surface and a border. The minute I have these two fragments, I was able to start and put them in different formulas and start creating different solution to it. A second step in the way of abstracting it was to stretch it and to allow a line of fruit to sit inside instead of a pile of fruit the way we see it. After fruit bowl number two, I decided to see if I'm able to find a way to connect between the border and the surface and to use just the border while it is being able to function and to contain fruits. Some people started calling them fruit racks. I insist that these are bowls because in our perception, we conceive bowl as something round that has a certain volume. I'm saying that our perception must start to be stretched over, and we can through object start learning and appreciating objects in different ways. This is the last one that I've done so far. This is the first one started 8 years ago, and this one has been designed about a year ago. That's how slow I am. But in this case, I was trying to reduce the bowl into an icon that still has the function of a bowl. In this part, I'm still talking about containers. However, I was looking for the specific point in time where an abstract object gets its function, meaning during the process of creating the functional object, in this case a vase, I was looking to see what will be the specific point or the specific action that makes it, that translates it from an object into a vase. So I started with very basic metal cylinders and sealed them from both ends and looking for different ways in order to open them and reveal their function. In this case, I was dissecting them in different places and used force in order to create the opening. The specific moment of using the force was the specific point where the object was born. However, after mass producing this specific piece, it revealed itself to become a commercial failure. I took it quite personally. It was one of the first objects that our studio mass produced, and we got stuck with a fairly nice amount of metal cylinders that I didn't know what to do with. So I decided that if I'm failing by taking control, I must find another way that will face the final form of the object. So we took them to the workshop and start running them literally over by cars. It ended up as a production of one of a kind, since they will never look alike. Five years later, I've been invited by a European company to design a set of wine glasses, and like most of the time, I'm juggling between ideas. I decided to use again the idea of how a function is being born. In this case, I started not with a tube, but with a perfect sphere, and then dissected it in different places in order to create the different function of the glasses. Production-wise, there is just one mold that create all the set of five wine glasses. These were the first prototypes at the studio, and this is the whole set. Going back to the cylinders, 6 years before, another way for me to try and create the function was by taking these cylinders to a shooting range and shooting them. In here, the idea was to start with an object, a functionless object, which is a dead object, and to kill it in order to give birth to it. However, the calipers were too small, and a flower was never able to fit into it, so they became, they stayed as objects. But I was trying to domesticate this idea and took iconic shapes of vases, sealed them and casted them in ceramic, and then slowly pierced them in different places in order to allow literally for it to function. Most of my objects doesn't reveal their function right away. I enjoy the fact that they carry some kind of a mystery in them. Although I use very basic shapes, I don't see myself as a designer who design new shapes or using new materials or new technologies. I use what I have. I do what I know. As I said, I try to tease a little bit our perception. Of course, we can all read it and read "I love Paris in the spring." However, if we will read it twice, we will see that the word "the" exists over there twice. We are in a stage that we are running so quickly to judge things. We don't take any time in order to observe and to see things. I want to try and slow this whole process and to receive more appreciation. Again, another series of containers, which are a research about a function, which is salt and pepper shakers. In this case, I was teasing our perception, which consider containers of salt and pepper as vertical containers. I was just trying to flip it and to create containers that can still function, but horizontally. Or hiding the function in a very strong icon that almost doesn't make any sense, that this icon, beside represent religious, can also become a salt and pepper shaker. While one part is the container of the salt and one part is the container of the pepper, I still been able to achieve the religious situation when the act of using it is against my own religious. We used to consider container by its volume. In this case, I was trying to smash the volume into almost a two-dimensional piece and hide the container behind a flat disk. The only hint for the function are the holes in this disk. Or using a very basic kitchen tool that I wish I knew how you say it in English.
Mortar and pestle.
Exactly. and also adding another component to it, which is its base, its pedestal, which at the end it almost looked like a useless decorative object on the table, yet it still contained the function. Talking about the way we see things, sometimes we see a duck and sometimes we see the rabbit. It's a very famous painting that tests our way of seeing things. These set of salt and pepper shakers started from an extended espresso cup. We were looking for the right handles for this espresso cup, and of course we started again, since I don't design things, I use what I see. The first option was to design the very classic shape of the handle, but since these two containers contain different grains, I wanted to find the definition between what is what. We did a small research about traditional British teacups, and we realized that lots of the handles somehow represent alphabet characters. So on one hand, we can consider them as two extended cups with different handles, and on the other hand, we can see actually the S and the P, which are not necessarily as obvious at the beginning. I take as much time as I can at my studio to allow myself and explore function in a very abstract way, to create objects that are not directly related to what will be their end result. If I'm talking about containers, so in this case, I was trying to examine the relationship between containers and their lid. When Paula saw it a couple of years ago at my studio, she said, "But Ron, this is art. I'm not an artist, so I don't create art. These are exploration of ideas." I used ready-made containers and rubber, and were looking all the time between to find the relationship between them. An interesting side effect of using rubber was the way it is being aged. I find it quite beautiful, however, I just keep it in the back of my mind. I have no idea what will be in the future with this kind of reveal. Surface. The first very object that I chose in order to explore how a surface is being created was a trivet. I created an outline of a surface by creating just four points, and then I was linking them with two dissecting lines. This was, for me, the minimum surface that can hold a pot on top of it. However, as greedy as I am, I tried to abstract it more, because for me that was not yet the minimum. So I tried to deconstruct it into three points that can create a versatile surface for different dishes. However, people who came to the studio said, "Oh, how cute are these coasters?" Cute is a word that I hate, and I don't enjoy when my objects considered to be cute. just because they are small. However, I took it personally, and I linked again these three points into two freestanding lines that still have the potential of versatility. Another way to treat a surface for me was to deconstruct it. The function was a basic coffee table. A coffee table serves all the people that surrounds it. In this case, I was dissecting it into slices, a personal portable slices that can hold a drink, an ashtray, or any other small object. Or taking a bookshelf and dissecting it again into specific fragments. Another way to treat a surface for me was to try to layer it. And I took one surface, which is a mattress, and I layered it on top of side tables and other surfaces in order to create a daybed. Or displacing a surface from the floor into the wall in order to create a shelf, or creating a freestanding shelf. In this case, I was just taking ready-made surfaces, serving plates, and elevated them to a stage where they are becoming platters by combining them with a very basic base structure. Or trying to see how I can tell a short story with a stool by trying to represent through its form the last person who was sitting on it before you. Until here, I was talking about the obvious, which is dealing with the surface itself and what's going on top of it. These two pieces are trying to explore what's going on underneath the surface. In here, I combined between a side table and the lamp and eliminated the surface and illuminated the underneath of it. Or a combination between a table and a vase, while the most essential fragment in it, the water that starts everything, that starts life, is basically underneath it, and the flowers goes through the surface and up. A more Salvador Dali was surrealist. A more surreal treat to a surface was to investigate the sound of it. Living in extreme capitalist New York, I was looking to find out what will be the sound of the good life. So I combined between the two most precious materials, which are crystal and a diamond, in order to see what will be the sound of the meeting point between the two of them. It sounds like any other bell. Just like with containers, I'm also playing with surfaces in the studio. However, and so far I showed you real things, which basically deals only with horizontal surfaces. At the studio, I'm allowing myself to be a little bit more wild and use any vertical surfaces I can use. Carving them in order to realize if they can contain another function. Peeling a layer of paint in order to see what's going on behind it. Being a little bit more aggressive and revealing the old versus the new, or using hammers in order to find out what the hell going on behind the surface. At a certain point, I was nailing candles into the wall and gave them the chance to make their own imprint. on the surface. I became a little bit obsessed with it, and after seeing the quality of the carbon, I started burning whatever I can see or whatever I have around me, mostly in order to learn how to control a flame. At this point, I've been invited by a European company to decorate a set of plates. My first presentation was a pile of plates that are all being burned, and they create different patterns when you are rotating them on a specific axis. However, they say with their Italian, Camandron, you are an artist. Try to be more of a designer. So I did a research about the history of decoration of plates, realizing that through the history, decoration was mostly about the object itself. And the minute that the object was in use, something was missing over there. You're piling the plate with food and you're losing the whole decoration. So it's a temptation about the object itself. It's not necessarily related to the function. I was looking for a way to apply graphics on the plate, and so it will be able to start and create some kind of an interaction between the object, the food, and the user. I started taking picture of my studio manager while standing on a ladder and starting to find the right position where when you're applying food on the plates, something is happening. I started with more extreme situations, which of course the Italians said, no way. And slowly I found things or positions which are much more settled and still create different kind of stories. This is the whole set. And this, someone set it up on a table, it's not me. Still staying with surfaces, but taking it further up, further away, further down, further something. In this case, I created a bench that I applied paint in shapes of negative of stools on it. It might look like four separate stools, but it's one piece of solid wood that its function is being revealed by the negative printed on it. Or creating single units, but in this case I was also creating symbols of tablecloth made of wood that represent a function of a side table and not a stool. A couple of years later, I said, why I need to deal just with fake negative. I want to create a real one. So I used the icon of a very basic stool and considered it as a void and then wrapped it around with a shipping box made of wood. However, the concept of shipping box and the idea of sitting on it with precious fabrics didn't work together, so I decided to try and upgrade it by using different materials. In this case, it was corian. The corian revealed itself to be very heavy and very expensive. So I was going back to the positive instead of the negative and was trying to create a much more simpler stool that uses much less material and somehow represent the positive. In these lamps, I'm trying to combine both the positive and the negative in order to create a volume. My friend Monica is saying that I'm a cheap Jew. And I thought that this remark was fitting very well the idea of creating half function. Since I'm part of the process of my creation is to reduce almost every unnecessarily fragment of the structure, sometimes I find myself going a little bit further and seeing that there are too many missing parts in order to create the function. However, I decided to use it to my own benefit and to offer half function objects in full price. I'm forcing the user to act in order to fill up the missing part and to complete the function. In the case of the vase makers, what I'm offering is just a ceramic tile with a miniature vase on top of it that supposedly hint on what it's supposed to do, and you can place it on top of any water container and create a vase. Same idea with the candlestick makers that has a missing limb and forces you to use a stable structure in order for it to become a candlestick. Or a fruit bowl, which is just a border, which the minute you are placing it on a surface, which is your table, is having the function of a container. Clipped cubes, which are just very basic squared cubes that are missing one corner, that by using some water and container are becoming vases. Or just a very simple tripod base that can accommodate any surface in order to serve different functions. Although I work around the clock, I do have some personal life. And once in a blue moon, I'm also lucky. In this series of work, I decided to use my personal life as an inspiration for a series of works. I created a small series of table lamps that has been inspired by characteristics of ex-lovers of mine. And my whole three-dimensional black book. We will probably speak soon, Paula, about what is art and what is design and what are we doing. And good, because I don't like to categorize myself. I create objects. Some of them are more functional than others. But I'm not afraid to quote things from one discipline and use them in others. In these cases, I call them still iframes. I use the frames that's supposed to frame a two-dimensional work and adding them a small leg so they will be able to freestand and frame not 2D but 3D objects. Or framing small mirrors inside a shadow box and even signing at the edge of it in order to question what the function is. Is it a piece of art or is it a functional mirror? Or using the classic pedestal that function as the support for sculpture and combining it with, in this case, miniature lamps, what makes out of it a floor lamp. However, in this case, when you're buying it, you're not just buying the light, you're also buying the public relation of it. In this case, the pedestal is function as a very essential part of the object because it also contains the water for the flower. Earlier in my career, I've been invited to have an installation in a very old gallery in Jerusalem. I hated the space. I was looking for a way to create the minimum in order to affect the space in a maximum way. I was creating a lighting fixture that is a representation of three-dimensional musical notation. While the staff is the electric wires and the notes are miniature abstracted everyday objects, a table, a chair, and a lamp. Do re mi. I think that the only person that was able to play this notation was John Cage, but at that time he was pushing daisies. However, the day after the opening, a nice lady came to the gallery with an umbrella and knocked off the whole installation. After designing so many vases in such a short time, I wanted to try and explore not the container itself, but what it holds, flowers. In a city where little kids might believe that flowers growing in buckets at the corner deli, I decided to use this as a material to even expand more the gap between flowers and nature and use flowers as raw material for me to explore our perception about time, chance, and beauty. And last but not least, a major part of my work is dealing with scale. Usually as designers, scale for us is a question of proportions. We are always looking for the right proportion of the object. I'm trying to avoid these rules and actually to extreme them to a situation when an object is being scaled down to the extreme where it almost doesn't relate anymore to our body, yet still is being able to contain its function. A couple of years earlier, it started to become very fashionable to design this huge crystal chandelier and lots of takes of them. After designing the Dear Ingo, I said that I will never design any more chandeliers. However, I wasn't able to see any more crystal chandeliers, so I decided that I will create the ultimate and last one for myself. And I miniaturize it into a scale that one can almost hold it. Or translating a fiery torch into a flimsy candle flame. or using the very classic, or I'll say iconic, Western shapes of table lamps and reducing them almost to the minimum while they're still able to contain a halogen bulb and provide enough light. Using the exact same, in this case, shapes, but in real scale, but combining them with an Eastern traditional of creating collapsible paper lanterns. The video.
Well, I'm very proud of you for having respected the time limit, even with the 149 slides. Uh-huh. Oh, yes, you did. You did a great job. I mean, you went a little over, but on purpose, you know, we decided, I consulted with Laura, and we decided to let you go over a little bit because it was so good. He's blinded by the light.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Now I'm blinded, too, by the light. It's okay. You'll get used to it. So this was great. And it was a really great survey. Before we came downstairs, we were talking, and we were saying, isn't it funny, you start working, and all of a sudden you work for a few years, and you're obsessed, and you do your thing, and all of a sudden you find yourself with a so-called body of work. You know, and it's interesting because you definitely have a body of work. How long have you been working?
In New York?
Not in New York, in design. How long have you been adding to your body of work?
I think that the oldest work that you've seen here was the torch, which was 14 years old.
You were...
No. It is 14 years old.
Oh, okay. But see, it's. I can really tell that you couldn't wait and be an architect and wait forever. You needed to get things done away.
Of course.
It's quite amazing. Well, I wanted to ask you, not really design and art, yeah, it doesn't matter here, but design and engineering, because you've been teaching in engineering school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting because when you see such poetic work and you see vases and flowers and apples and little girls with red dresses on...
Cute stuff.
I would say poetic stuff. I would never call it cute. But you don't think of engineering. And instead, the making of these things mm-hmm. is so important for the poetry of mm-hmm. them in the end. So... what is your relationship to making things? Do you go in the workshop and make them?
Of course.
Okay, talk about that.
Well, I was very lucky because I collaborated with a business partner who his passion is engineering. However, at the beginning, I was such a control freak that I didn't allow anyone to have any input in my work. However, slowly I realized that a straightforward mind of an engineer creates a much more interesting and simple solutions than a designer. So since then I let loose, and I think that sometimes he's getting some kind of an assignments which are being answered by with a much smarter answers than myself. Of course that at least for the last 3 years I used to visit the workshop once or twice a week because it was very important for me to create things by myself. I do have the ability or knowledge in order to silver solder or to machine wood, etc., and I think that this is also a much more releasing situation in the process of being a designer. Sitting all day in front of your desk or lying in the couch and daydreaming, which I'm trying to do as much as I can, sometimes can exhaust you. So I think that the physical act of it, it's not just the physical, it's the physical part of your brain that is working differently when you're thinking about the technical parts. Release some kind of a juice that can make you more happy.
Definitely. Endorphins. It's like going to the gym, but better.
Yeah.
Where do you get things made?
Why?
Where?
Well, it depends, because all the objects that I showed you are stretching between prototypes, one-of-a-kind, limited editions, all the way to mass production. We started most of our production six years ago in the United States. Actually, it started with very small quantities by ourselves at the workshop, and slowly we found the right manufacturers in order to produce in larger quantity our pieces. However, I'm a very tough partner as a part of a design company because I never focus on a specific technology or specific material. I think about the idea and its design and the part of the material, if it's not part of the concept, is being thought after effect. So if we are finding the ultimate porcelain manufacturer in China, which is something that is almost impossible, but we do, the day after I come up with an idea that relates to glass blowing. And then you need to outsource and find the right manufacturer that can produce your specific next object, basically. We are trying to produce as much as we can in the United States. I'm not American, but I live here, and I'm trying to be as patriot as possible. If I was able to produce in Israel, I would definitely produce in Israel.
But also producing in the United States allows you to be a control freak, so you can go and see what happens.
No, because sometimes it's in nowhere, Nevada.
Nevada, what happened? Yeah. It's so easy to get to Nevada.
No. I don't leave my studio.
I know, that's true. He doesn't leave his studio. His studio, when I met him 6 years ago, he used to be in Soho. Then he moved to Tribeca. And literally, I've never met him. Met you outside. I've always come to your studio.
True.
Yeah, no, you're always there. And now he moved to Williamsburg, which is the office that you've seen in the video. And I haven't been there yet because it's so far. But
it is. It is.
But it's true. You don't leave your studio.
No. I chose it specifically because it isolated from all the hassle that happens in New York. I mean, 6 years in New York for me were a little bit too much. And I see myself, although I find the Americans so welcoming, I'm not sure that I'm able to accommodate the extreme consumerism culture in here, et cetera, et cetera. Although I create, you know, tempting objects, and I can consider them even as dust collectors, no one really needs them, I still think that I'm looking for a place which is much more relaxed and not necessarily deals all the time with money.
Let's talk then about how your objects enter people's lives, because they are like little people. They are like little characters. Mm-hmm. They have their own personality. And so the moment they enter your house, you have this theater, this landscape populated by, you know, you have your girlfriends in lamps, and then you have, you know, the little boxing ring, and the apples also become characters. So a house all made with your objects could become like a real obsessive landscape, because there would be too many people. It would be too crowded. So how do you think of your objects in the world? Do you even think about that?
Now that I'm on drugs, no.
But you used to?
I used to be obsessed, and I used to know, I used to die knowing exactly who is the person who is buying my object and where exactly they're going to place
remember
it, on
it's so
how they're going to use it, of course. But I realize that I can control something up until the door of my studio. The minute that I release something, it has its own life. And since I was talking about the fact that I see my object as suggestions, so I think that the rest of the story should be told by its user.
That's very true. They are suggestions, because they are just the beginning of the whole picture in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there's a difference between some of your objects, like the chandeliers or the beautiful street lamp, that are kind of finite, and then instead objects like the frames or the dishes that are just waiting for something to happen to them as to be complete. But I'm proud of you that you can release them at the door of your studio. It's true, you were not like that once. Before I take up all the time, because I have many questions, I want to give you space too. Do you have any questions also from the audience? Or you can think them up. Well, there's one over there. Do we have microphones for? Okay. I'm going to just mix your questions with mine.
We have microphones.
It's coming to you. Great.
Thank you. When you first started, how did you finance your endeavors?
That's a good question. There you go.
Yeah. This is a $25 admission question, not a $10 admission question. I had sponsors. I had sponsors who were willing to take a huge risk and believe in the potential of the way I think and put their money in it.
Did they
I think they made
money?
A mistake.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Did they make the money back? No.
No, never. you cannot make money creating these kind of objects. Impossible for me. Impossible. I'm trying. I'm trying. I'm. I'm. I'm not obsessed about it, but when you see the way a gallery or a store is displaying your object, and you realize that even the buyer that bought it didn't really understand it, so how you can expect a potential buyer to understand it? People are asking if the vase makers are coming with red glasses instead of clear glasses. That's how stupid we are.
I don't know. Sometimes we underestimate people. Sometimes it's just the wrong setting. I think that you just need a little bit of isolation and then people understand. Mm-hmm. With a little pause, they can understand. That's what museums are for. Mm-hmm. It's to change gears.
True. However, also in museums, we are walking automatically and we see another Picasso and another Matisse, et cetera, et cetera. And we are already got used to a Pollock and to a Manet, and we are exposed even to contemporary art, which is most shocking. And the rough of our expectations is going so high that it's very hard to find a way to make people stop.
When you're traumatized by the Picassos, just come to the third floor. Uh-huh. You know, and that's what I'm always telling people. Just drop the Picassos. Come to the architecture and design. Are there any other questions from the audience right now? Please. Let me just repeat the question very quickly. He would like to know if Ron is affected by the physical environment in which he lives and or works, I suppose.
I mean, for example, your move to Williamsburg from Tribeca.
Fortunately and unfortunately, I always lived and worked in the same space. So I have the chance to experience my creations firsthand. If I was to choose, I wouldn't live among my objects.
Really? Why?
I don't like to own things. I don't buy things unless I have to. I have a lecture, so I will buy a pair of pants, but that's it.
They're very nice.
Thank you very much. I do think that it gives me an opportunity to explore things beyond the 9-to-5 situations. I'm able to explore the amount and the quality of light of my objects, and I'm able to play with them as much as I can. And I'm being bored with things very quickly, so things are being changed. And by changed, I mean that I'm not right away going and creating a new piece. I'm just moving one piece from one place to the other, and I'm starting to learn how it affects the piece or how it affects its environment.
There was somebody else that had a question. Yeah, over there, Susan. Wait, the microphone is coming to you.
A new old idea is the limited edition. It seems to have really taken over a lot of galleries. What do you think of that phenomenon?
I'm growling. You talk about it. And then.
I'm trying to be, as a person and in my work, as authentic as possible. I grew up in a different culture, and I've been raised on socialist values. However, I'm here in America, and I cannot just ignore all the temptation and all the trends that surrounds me here. On one hand, I do think that it's very pompous and pretentious to create limited edition pieces, et cetera, et cetera. I once said that I've been asked in an interview if I think that an object can have a political influence, and I said that if you will show me one vase that can serve as a catalyst for world peace, I'm going to get recircumcised. So, I do create limited edition pieces, most of the time because they're almost impossible to mass produce, or if I will mass produce them, they will become so expensive or so unappealing to people that it will be a failure or too much of a risk. Our studio founded 6.5 years ago. I still consider ourselves in a very early age, and I'm lucky that I have the freedom to explore as much as I can and to play in between the world of limited editions, one of a kind, and mass productions.
But when you say limited edition, say for instance, the salt and pepper shakers, the stick
silver ones.
The silver ones. They are difficult to produce, but you don't say, I'm going to produce only 10 so that they increase in value. If somebody comes to you and says, I want the 11, 12, 15, mm-hmm. you're not going to say no, right? So that's different.
Some pieces I do limited. Some pieces I do, I decide about an addition. Listen, I'm not greedy, but life in New York is very tough, and one need to make a living.
I know, you're talking to a militant.
People are coming to my studio and say, I want this. However, when they realize that it's an open edition, they will not be willing to pay for it $20. When they will see my signature and they will see one out of 900, they will be willing to pay for it $100.
Okay, 900 is acceptable. 900 is acceptable. Just
it's no, 900 is a Salvador Dali print. It's not a Ron Gilad piece.
But that's a good question because it's a we can have a big one day debate on this and really rip our hairs off, you know. But it's a very good one.
No, on one hand, you are enjoyed that you are creating something that you are very pleased with, a good object, not failures. And you're somehow spreading your sperm all around the globe, and you're realizing that someone in nowhere have just purchased it and being able to enjoy it. But on the other hand, all the hassle of producing and marketing and selling and all of these kind of things, although allowing me the freedom to create whatever I want, what a big Italian company will never say yes to, but it throw me to places where all I want is to create just one-of-a-kind pieces, not because I want to sell them as sculptures in hundreds of thousands of dollars, although I would not be opposed to it, but because I don't think that this statement is supposed to be duplicated. It's one statement, just like the chandelier. It was one joke.
It only was one? There's only one? It's so funny because I've seen so many pictures of it. I thought you had made many. It's like, I thought you had made many. Sorry.
I have a business partner. I'm not making all the decisions. There was one prototype that we created as the object itself. And then we've been approached by blah, 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 and we produced a total of 20 pieces. We didn't consider them or call them an edition of 20 pieces, and we sold them in a very fair price as if they've been mass-produced.
Okay,
then
good.
Then we've been approached by a Dutch company, and they started mass-producing them, et cetera, et cetera. Now people are willing to pay a couple of dozens of thousands of dollars for one of the 20 pieces that we produced. I'm not going to see this money, and I don't want to see this money, but the idea that someone is willing to pay this amount for a little joke is ridiculous.
Well, yeah, I agree. No, it's true. Okay. Can I ask one question, and then I'll get to you? Just one very quick question. I always thought, you know, there are people like me and you, we kind of get lost in objects because objects are so, are worlds unto themselves. You make them, I look at them. How's your relationship with people?
It's been improving.
Because I always say that I'm so much better with objects than with people, that that's why I have this job. That's why I'm asking you. It's out of sympathy.
Yeah, but are you a collector of objects?
No. Nope. You neither. Are you a collector of
people? No, I have none.
Do you collect people? No.
No.
Neither. It's very interesting. Sometimes the world of objects and the world of people can exclude each other sometimes. That's why I was asking. That it's interesting because you make objects that are likely to people.
Yes.
Little universe onto itself. I'm going into difficult territory here, so I'm going to pass. You had it. Yes, please.
It sounds like it's frustrating
to you. Oh, sorry. No, it's okay. I didn't see that you were raising. Then I'll come to you. Mm-hmm. Go for it. Yeah.
How dare you?
It sounded like it's maybe frustrating when you walk into stores that are selling your stuff and you see how they interpret it. Does it ever stimulate you? Because it sounds like you have these suggestive items that you want to open up people's imaginations how to use it, but where does that border between the frustration and what stimulates you, how people go and, you know, execute how you've what you've created?
I will use a cliche to answer you. There is a very fine line between good and bad in these cases. And I think that when I'm saying half a function, meaning that I've done half of the job, so I expect someone to do the other half the way they want, but not to take from my half and reduce it into a quarter. Because to pay a full price for a quarter function will be a little bit expensive.
The gentleman over there, and then I'll come to you.
The question I have is, your objects are always a beginning for the user. At what point do you stop when you feel that you've reached the point that you can let it go for the next person?
Did you hear the question? He asked, you know, the Ron's objects tend to be a beginning for the users. They suggestions, as Ron was saying before. So, Ron, where do you, how do you find out, and when do you know where to stop in order to leave space for the other person?
Brian, I have no idea. Seriously, it's hard for me to answer on it. I think that.
I don't think you stop at all. I think you get to the end of your.
I think that the process of creating each object is very different. Although I do have my own rules and my own yes and no's when I'm creating. I try not to use colors. I not using cutting edge technologies. There are no programmed brains in my objects. The maximum electricity will be an on and on switch, etc., etc. So there is something that connects between all of them, but I think that the process itself, since each time it deals with either a different function or a different approach to a function, each time I will stop at a certain point that relates to the specific process.
Yes.
Where'd you get your pants? Just kidding. Question. As a product designer, how do you deal with the fact that we live in a world that's just so full of stuff?
Oh, my God. I'm not afraid to laugh about myself and to say that my objects are dust collectors. I think that one of the reasons of thinking about not mass producing things and trying to focus on very specific statements and create and producing them in very limited editions or one of a kind is one of the reasons for it. but I do try to make sure that if I produce something in China, it's not being produced in a sweatshop or something like this. But yeah, I mean, I'm criticizing it as much as you are, but on the other hand, I'm adding oil to this machine. Unfortunately, it's definitely a conflict. It's definitely a conflict that I think that my way of dealing with it is the attempt to not just create an object that is desirable and relates to immediate purchase or
impulse buy.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Impulse buy, but something that makes you slow down a little bit, something that makes you, that tempts you at the beginning to get closer because it looks so familiar, and then when you are falling into this trap of what the hell it is, it will take you a little bit more of a time, and suddenly you will start realizing things and thinking about it. I think that if an object has the ability to make you accept it and not as a typical consumer that you see something today and you say, oh, this is new, it's interesting, and then you're turning around and you're going back and you're saying, oh, I've seen it before, this is not new. I do in my designs try as much as I can to eliminate any ornaments or shapes or things that relate to fashion and to a specific period of time. I don't want to get into the cliche of I'm trying to create classics. Only time will say what I'm creating. But I can give you an example that the vase makers has been designed 7.5 years ago. Right now, we are starting to sell it to the European market after 7.5 years ago. For them, it's something which is totally new, and they don't see the time or the place that it has been designed.
Interesting, because I hadn't thought before of how indifferent to technology your design is.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is that because of this indifference to technology, of course, those small lights could be done only with halogen, so that dates them. But otherwise, all the other design could truly have been designed at any moment mm-hmm. in the 20th century. That's a very beautiful thing. You make your design timeless by really suspending. I mean, you don't do it on purpose, but it is timeless in a way.
Or because I'm a retard.
Other questions?
I do what I know.
Yeah, which is you do what you know, which is what we. But you'd also do what we all know in a way, which is nice. Any other questions from the audience? Yes.
I'll repeat that. I just wanted to comment on the question of additions, which is coming to me as a surprise because, in a sense, not even totally sincere to reality because the idea of repeating or reproduction started with printing, and what would we do without having all the thousands and thousands of books from one book? How would everyone read that book if we wouldn't have that reproduction? So the same with additions. I don't see, especially if you're talking about socialist background, I don't see a problem with having sharing the object that you design mm-hmm. with more people.
This is such a difficult question. I mean, it's a difficult issue.
I don't think that one must own one of my objects in order to carry with him its idea. It's not necessarily the physical experience of living among this object. I think that being here and listening to the lecture and just seeing the visions is something that you can take with you. It's not about, I must go and buy Ron Gilad right now. It's about, I've seen what he's doing and I see how one conceives objects, and maybe I will think about it differently tomorrow when I will hold a glass.
If I may interject for a moment, because it's something that I've been thinking for a long time, because you know this whole museum has from the beginning was founded on thinking that design was the one instance in which everybody could have art in their lives. So it's founded on the idea of design spreading its sperm everywhere, as Ron was dreaming of. And so I am instinctively a little bit very mistrusting of additions, unless they are additions out of necessity, because there's just so much of that material, because this designer is going to lose all of his blood if he does more than six. So it is that kind of addition makes sense. The problem is that, just like Ron said very honestly before, because of the market today, whatever happened, we don't know, but it's gone really bananas. It's very tempting for designers sometimes to indulge in additions because, you know, if they have people that are willing to pay a few dozens of thousands of dollars, as Ron said, for a joke, you know, we only wish as curators that the money really went to the designers, you know, I mean, if there's a chance for that to happen. But it's contrary to the idea of design in a way, unless it is necessary for a question of manufacturing. I mean, that's my viewpoint. But truly, I mean, as we speak, there's Frieze, the Frieze Art Fair in London, and I was invited, and I couldn't go for other reasons, to participate in a panel that would have been really a bloody fight exactly on this particular theme. You know, so I'm sorry that I'm not there, but it's a big theme. Mm-mm. But I don't think that he's one of the guiltiest. No, he really isn't.
Yet.
I don't even know if it's the galleries. It's somebody else. We don't have enough money to say that it's us.
Capitalism.
Capitalismus. Any other questions? Okay, first over there, the lady over there, and then the guy with the blue shirt. Is that?
I personally don't see anything wrong with limited editions. It is like if you want to have a relationship with a piece of design and you want to have that relationship in your own house and you know there are only five of them in the world, it's kind of like having a piece of the designer's mind. And I do understand that people sometimes, although they cannot pay for it, save a lot of money for it to have that. In a sense, it's like an artwork. It's like having a piece of that designer's mind. I don't see anything wrong with it.
Can we just move away from the limited series for a second and focus on Ron? I mean, truly, it's very interesting.
Especially
we could
have
a big discussion.
This specific lady owned like half of my brain.
Yeah, well, good for her. Just, is the next question... You're not going to ask about limited editions, okay.
Mark? Yes. I think your work is quite influential, and in the slideshow of the slides that you've shown, at least two of those objects of your origin have been copied by other people. And I guess my question is, have you taken any steps to prevent people from copying your work, and how do you feel about it? Do you take it as a compliment, or are you threatened by it or upset by it?
I'm quoting others. I'm feeling very comfortable about it. I admit it when I'm doing something which is influenced by someone, so I will probably name the piece after this person. I don't see anything wrong with basing, again, what we are doing on something that was already exist. I do think that it's important that we will add on this existing thing, our own perception or our own take on it. As for...
But you've taken out a patent, no?
One.
Yeah, one, but still. Yeah. You've been trying to protect yourself. What's the patent for?
No, vase maker. No, this is having a business partner. This is not being an artist. And people copied the idea of the vase maker, not once and not twice. It's fine. It's fine. What can you do about it? It's not that I'm concerned that they will take my income out of making these copies. It's very frustrating for me to see that people will go so far or will go very low in order to fulfill their greediness or the marathon after material. It's a horrible answer, but that's what I have.
How would you say that your training as an architect has incised into your work? I mean, in the slideshow, you talk about volumes, containers, and services, which seem quite an architectural language to me, anyway.
For some reasons, in America, everything that is square is called architectural, and everything that is round is called sculptural. I don't see any architectural elements in my work. Architecture is about creating a shell around our body to prevent...
That's simplistic.
No, it's not. It just makes sense.
Yes,
of course.
Come on.
Of course, yeah, because today architecture is for rich people.
Oh, really? Limited editions are for rich people, not architecture.
Of course. Can you compare a little cute monster that I create to another monster that Zaha Hadid is making in Saudi Arabia?
No, but your equivalent in architecture is not Zaha Hadid, it's more Stephen Hall. So Stephen Hall can do little monsters too. No, it's. I think that what Kat, I know her, so that's why I'm coming to her defense. What she was asking was more about the frame of mind, the way you build the objects. And as a matter of fact, the idea, especially in the United States, the idea that you're talking about surface and border mm-hmm. immediately makes people think about architecture because mm-hmm. it is the way that architecture is taught here, not in Europe and I don't know about Israel, but here it's really that kind of, they always talk about conditions, the condition of border, condition of surface. Yeah, it's true. It's always like the condition of kitchen. And I'm like, it's a kitchen. It's not a condition. But I think that's where she was coming from. So don't you think that you build objects? No, it's not the way. It doesn't. You don't use your architectural formation at all.
No.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Sorry. Okay. Any other questions coming from you? I don't know, how are we doing with time, Laura? Are we good? Oh, so that's the time that we should more or less close.
5 minutes
close.
Ago.
Huh?
Five minutes ago.
No, that's okay. Time really flew because there's so much to talk about. But I'm so glad that you came and you showed a whole
pleasure.
Universe. No, it was really great also for me to see it all together because I've seen it a lot across the years. Now I've seen the body of work.
No. You know that it starts as from 270 slides.
I know. Those I will see another night.
149 was a very tough job.
Some tequila and many cigarettes. We'll just go through the whole 270 slides. But thank you so much, Ron. It's been great. You've
done a great job. Thank you, my dear.